Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio. Welcome to Beer Me. I'm your host, Sarah Jane. Typically, we are recording live at the Line Hotel, but for this summer, we are doing something a little different. We are doing Beer Me on the road. So whether it is a local brew pub or brewery or somewhere outside of Washington, D.C., we'll still be looking at the beer world through different lenses. Brewers, educators, importers, to get a different viewpoint of this fascinating and dynamic world that is beer. So for the first episode of Beer Me on the Road, I was able to sit down with newly elected president of the DC Homebrewers Club, Omar Al-Nadawi. We sat down at Saloon, a very old school bar on U Street in Washington, D.C., and over a few pints, we were able to have a discussion about malt. Listen in. So I'm joined here today by Omar Al-Nadawi. I said it wrong. Please correct me. Omar
Al-Nadawi.
Al-Nadawi. I even wrote it down phonetically and I got it wrong. Brava on my part here. So he is the newly elected president of the DC Homebrew Club. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And the reason why I wanted to speak with you today is because you are in the process of doing a really cool malt-driven experience. Now, in the past years, hops have kind of been the sexy thing in beer. Everyone focuses on hops. Oh, what hops do you use? There are a lot of beers that do single variety hops so that you can really smell and taste these particular hops. And I feel like consumers more and more are really understanding what certain hops taste like. They're beginning to understand, okay, so Southern Hemisphere hops are more tropical, more fruity, Pacific Northwest, piney, citrusy, like people know this. However, I'm with you. I don't think malt gets its due as far as the role that it plays in beer and how each different varietal can really, really affect what the end result is in a beer. So tell us a little bit about this experiment. Start from the very beginning, kind of how you started to put this together.
Well, it starts with my passion for malt. I think it's the most important component of beer. I mean, of course, all the other components, water, yeast, hops are beautiful and important and critical in a beer, and they contribute a lot. But malt is the heart of beer. You can brew a beer without hops, but you can't brew a beer without malt.
True.
So I think there has been a certain underappreciation for malt in the beer culture. I think this is particularly true, as you said, in the United States, since the craft beer revolution started in the last few decades. So I'm trying to do my part to put in my two cents to correct this and help discover or shed light on some aspects of malt where we can add a lot of flavor, where we can maximize what we can get out of this, you know, beautiful ingredient. So at DC Homebrewers, we try often to organize group experiments to include as many club members as possible and have them actively participate in the educational activities so that everyone can get their hands dirty and make the beers, learn from the process, and share that knowledge with the other brewers and the rest of the club, both through interactions during the execution of the experiment and also during the unveiling of the results. So Actually, for this experiment, we were originally thinking about tasting or putting stouts to the test.
So basically making the same stout recipe with different ones.
Yes, okay. we're thinking about brewing potentially half a dozen stouts, simple stout recipes, mm-hmm. with the same base malt or pale malt component, which would be about 85% of the beer, and using a variety of dark roasted malts to make up the remainder, 15% or so, which would give that, what makes a stout a stout.
Yes.
But because, summer is already here, and we thought that, few people would be interested in drinking and sampling that many stouts in a row. We thought that to keep things interesting and to encourage people to participate and to sample the resulting beers, that we could probably modify this a little bit. And the resulting concept was equally as interesting. We decided that we, with my colleagues in the education committee, to come up with an experiment that focuses on crystal malts, which are another loved, sometimes hated ingredient of beer.
Okay, so why are they loved and why are they hated?
So they are loved because they provide a unique bit of sweetness, a warmth, in terms of color. They provide a reddish tone to the beer. They provide a little bit of something, really a spectrum of flavors, anywhere from subtle honey flavors all the way to burnt sugar and dark fruit flavors, depending on their level of caramelization that has been introduced in the malting and kilning process. So they are loved for reasons, for these mm-hmm. qualities that they contribute to a beer, and they improve head retention and stability of foam. There are styles that you cannot brew without a good crystal malt, but they're also hated by a lot of brewers and a lot of beer consumers who prefer their beers to be as dry as possible and as bitter as possible. So if you go to any, if you look at any classic West Coast IPA, you're not going to find any trace of crystal malt. If you also, similarly, if you look at the new wave of hazy IPAs, you will find flaked oats and flaked wheat, but you're not going to find any crystal malts. So, because they are kind of looked down upon as these things that distract and take away from the from the hop character, which is what most people are.
They're after.
A lot of people
after
are after. Yeah, they want their beers to be dry. They want them to be bursting with hop flavor, and they don't want any residual sugar or color or chewiness, so to speak, to get in the way. So these are the reason in a nutshell the reasons for which they are loved.
For the love and the hate. So you're doing crystal malt. And you're doing this in what style of beer?
So, we decided to on a style that highlights the crystal malt, mm-hmm. and also one really that cannot be brewed without a crystal malt. So, we picked the English bitter, best bitter style, which is a very drinkable beer style.
Low ABV,
very low in alcohol, easy to drink. It's not highly carbonated. You can drink three or four in a row without feeling, tipsy or inebriated.
And ironically not bitter.
Exactly. I mean, the name is quite misleading. But when brewed well, these beers are exquisite and quite refreshing, even in a hot weather.
But like malt is star of the show. For these
malt
beers.
Is the star of the show.
Yeah.
The hops play a supporting role, an mm-hmm. important supporting role, but know, again, they're supposed to be, they have a little bit of solid bitterness, but malt is the key flavor component.
So you're doing a best bitter style, you are using crystal malts, and then you're using different variations of crystal malt.
Right.
So what, you said you chose six different variations?
Six different variations, and another beer that's sort of a control sample. And I can tell you more about this.
And sorry, but for people just tuning in, I'm sitting down and talking with Omar Al-Madali. He is the president of the DC Homebrewers Club. We're talking about an experiment that the DC Homebrewers Club is doing to explore kind of specific variations of crystal malts. So what are the six different crystal malt variations that you are using?
So, just to list them.
Mm-hmm.
The traditional or the almost the default choice for brewing an English bitter would be to use an English crystal malt, usually in the medium range of color. So that's something we definitely want to include. Then we thought the American caramel malts or crystal malts, you can use the names interchangeably, are often described as bland or, you know, don't have a lot of complexity in their flavor, so we decided to test that too. And then we thought maybe we can include a few other examples of continental crystal malt. So we added a Belgian crystal malt of similar level of caramelization and color as the other two, and a German crystal malt known as Karamunich. Then we to include the some of the newer varieties or the less frequently used varieties, we added a new malt called Opal 44 from an American craft maltster. They call it, I think, Mecca Grade. And the final addition to the experiment was another English specialty crystal malt called Karastan, which is labeled or usually referred to as a toffee malt. And I've been always curious about this for a while. And finally, we're not over yet, actually. We added a seventh beer that we will brew, or have brewed already, entirely with a new variety of specialty malt. So it's a new malt that's called Red X that is basically, it's a base malt, but is supposed to have some of the qualities of a crystal malt. So it can contribute on its own some of the sweetness and color contributions that brewers usually need to get a crystal malt to in order to obtain. So we got together and agreed on recipe parameters. You know, what's the alcohol level going to be? What water chemistry we're going to use? What amount of hops we're going to use? And
so everything else in the recipe is the same for all the beers.
Yes.
Using the same hops.
Yes.
All the waters have to have the same pH and mineral content.
Exactly.
And it has to have the same ABV. The only thing that you're changing.
Same yeast, of course.
So same yeast, Same yeast. Yeah. The only thing that you're changing is just the malt, I think.
Yes. And okay. So we're trying to make this the only variable.
Okay.
As you know, as close as we can get to that, so that when we try the six or seven beers next to each other, we can, with a certain level of confidence, attribute that difference that we perceive to that one variable, and try to eliminate the noise from other differences in process or recipes.
And so the idea then is to really, really get a grasp of, like, a real-life experience of what these malts, how they affect the beer. What the mouthfeel is like, what the aroma is like, what the sight is like, what it tastes like, everything.
Yes.
And this is because, well, I mean, you're obviously doing this for fun, but, you know, when you read descriptors, it only gives you so much information. Correct.
That's correct. when you read the descriptors that are available on online stores or at the description packets of labels of products, you see a lot of language that sometimes is redundant, sometimes is really, you read it and it makes, you know, it sounds like a lot of information, but then what does it mean? You hear that, you read that it's, you know, toffee, caramel, and dark fruit, but what does that mean?
Yeah. No, so, I mean, taste is so subjective.
So,
you know,
exactly.
Like dark, it may, to you, it may taste exactly like dried figs, but to me, it may taste exactly like, you know, Werther chocolate candy or caramel candy or whatever. So you, it's good to place that kind of in your memory.
Exactly. And we want to also try and see, well, of those 12 or 15 or, you know, there's a multitude of malts and of options that you can use for a recipe. You look at any malt there and say, like, suitable for various, for, you know, for a broad range of styles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's good, but which one is the best? Which one is the right option?
Which malt is best for an English-style bitter?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's a secondary objective. I know it's not everyone is going to be very enthusiastic about this one because, you know,
it's not everyone's making English.
Not everyone. Yeah. I mean, I love English styles, but not everyone does. But I think that's also a bonus result that we'll get, you know, out of this experiment. But really, the key objectives is to learn about what these malts bring to the table, and also to, you know, enjoy the experience. Now, what I hope that we'll be able to get out of this is the fact that British English bitter was really not the original. You know, we didn't aim for an English bitter, but in attempting to create a blank canvas for which, on which the crystal malt of choice can shine, we ended up with an English bitter. So it's just because it's, you know, what we liked about the recipe is that it allows the malt to shine. Doesn't get in the way. It's just enough bitterness to make the beer drinkable, but not too much that it overpowers the malt, and also not a lot of malt character from other sources, so as to, you know, complicate the picture. It's the least complicated recipe that we can come up with to evaluate a crystal malt.
I gotcha. So as far as the process goes, this has been brewed, and a lot of them are already in bottle, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Most of the beers have been packaged, they're conditioning, and definitely all of them will be ready to try on June 20th when our club meets for its next monthly meeting.
Okay.
Which will be at Smoke and Barrel in Adams Morgan.
Nice.
People are encouraged to, you know, come find us on Facebook, GC Home Brewers. We have a Google group as well.
It's probably the most welcoming group of people I've ever encountered.
We are always welcoming of new members.
Yeah. Now, and just to take a step back here, for the listeners who maybe aren't familiar, people who are new to homebrewing, what is the purpose of conditioning in the bottle? Like, after you bottle it, why do you let that beer settle?
Well, there are two paths. After you have brewed the beer, then you have fermented the beer. Now the beer is basically done. The yeast has done its work. Comes packaging after that. And there are two paths or multiple paths that you can come, in which you can go from there. A lot of people, myself included, will put the beer in bottles, add a small amount of sugar solution, to give the yeast a little bit more food to chew on and produce a little bit of extra carbon dioxide so that the beer comes carbonated and lively and not flat and boring.
And that also adds to the aroma and, you know, some of the mouthfeel. Well,
most contributions to the flavor and aroma has been done, like, in the primary fermentation. But, you know, carbonation and conditioning helps clarify the beer. I think, you know, time spent in the bottle helps, you know, the yeast, allows the yeast to do its job, get the extra carbonation, and then settle down.
But when you pour that beer, that carbonation allows for the aromas to kind of pop out.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. No, yeah. And that, you're absolutely correct. Of course, the other path is for people who think that, you know, bottling is cumbersome, is to keg the beer. And you can do a forced carbonation, forced introduction of carbon dioxide into the beer by pouring your entire beer batch into a keg. You seal it and you apply carbon dioxide pressure from a bottle, carbon dioxide bottle, and you can achieve similar results in much shorter periods of time. Bottle conditioning often takes 2 weeks, sometimes more if the beer is high in alcohol, but carbonation in a keg can take as few as a, you know, a few days, 2 or 3 days, or less even.
I gotcha. Okay. So at this point, they will be 100% ready by the meeting on the 20th.
You have to chill them a little bit.
Chill them a little bit. Yeah. Chill them a little bit. But
not too much, though, because they're English style, so you don't want them too cold.
You don't want them too cold. Now, has the DC Homebrewers Club done other experiments like this?
We've done, not exactly like this, but okay, perhaps even larger in scope. This past spring, winter spring, we did an experiment in which we made about 11 different beers. The idea of that one was to constrain the brewers to one type of malt and one type of hops, but give them the freedom to use styles, recipes, and yeast, and to go crazy and test the limits of what can be done with just one malt and one hop.
But they could add anything else they wanted.
They could do anything, but not other ingredients.
Okay, so they couldn't add, like, fruit, spices?
No.
Okay,
they can use any form of, any type of, you know, microorganisms for fermentation.
Okay.
But in terms of ingredients, those were the limits.
And so they couldn't use additional malt? They couldn't use additional malt?
They cannot.
Okay. Yeah. I'm seeing it now.
So, you know, I think the motivation for that experiment was sometimes you go on a forum and you see a brewer saying, well, I have, you know, just this one malt and just a few types of hops. What can I possibly brew other than a simple pale ale?
Yeah.
So in that experiment, we wanted to test we wanted to accept the challenge and say, well, what can't you brew with just one malt and one hop?
Mm-hmm.
So we had like 10 or 11 completely different beers.
Yeah.
We had a Berliner Weiss that was fermented with three different microorganisms. We had Brett Saisons. We had Belgian Blondes. We had an ESB, an English Special Bitter.
Yeah.
We had alt beers. We had Kolsches. We had pale ales and IPAs. We had people collect yeast from their backyards. We had people use three-hour boils to get different colors and different malt expressions. So, yes, I mean, no one managed to brew a stout from one, you know, from one malt, but the variety of beers was really outstanding. And
that's wonderfully creative. I love that.
You could not, walking in into, you know, to that room and trying all those beers, you could not have told that those came from the same sack of grain and the same bunch of hops.
Yeah.
So that was a fun experiment that we did this year. A year before that, we did a similar experiment, but the variable in that one was another overlooked component of beer, which is grain adjuncts. We want to basically brew a dozen batches of the same beer, with the one variable being, 20% of the fermentables coming from an unusual grain or a, what we call an adjunct.
So like spelt or rice or corn.
So these would be the usual suspects.
Okay.
Oats, rice, rye, wheat, spelt, but then we had buckwheat and amaranth and sorghum and I can't even remember all the grains that we had. We set out to test six of them. We ended up testing 13 different grains. Some of them you could just toss into the mash right away. Others required a cereal mash, like boiling, cooking the grain.
Based on the grain, it greatly affects how you're handling it.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
It can go. I'm in no way, shape, or form a brewer, but from what I understand, there are certain ones that are more of a pain in the ass than other ones.
Yeah, that's the fact that some of our brewers experienced.
All right, so what's
brewing
the
quinoa is different from using flaked barley.
Okay, yeah. What's the grain that requires the most TLC? What's the diva of the grain world?
Trying to remember, I think it was either buckwheat or amaranth. I think.
Yeah.
Oh, teff.
Teff.
Yeah, that was teff.
Teff, an ancient grain originating from what, North Africa?
Yeah, some of those were like really hard to grind because they're tiny or required a cereal mash. And cereal mashes are notoriously, unpleasant processes because you have this pot of boiling gelatinous liquid and of grain and water that you have to watch like a hawk for an hour while the grains get ready to be introduced to the mash. So it's an almost dangerous process, actually.
Okay. Well, this is a really exciting experiment. I'm really intrigued to see how this turns out and what malt reigns supreme. So listeners out there, if you are interested in homebrewing at all, there are a lot of really great shops in the area. If you go on the Homebrewers Association website, they can point you in the direction of a lot of different shops, a lot of different resources. DC Homebrewers Club, like I said before, they are by far and away the most welcoming group of people, the sweetest group of people. They will answer all of your questions. They will welcome you with open arms. They will give you a lot of free beer. So check out their Facebook group and go to their meetings because they're a lot of fun. Omar, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me, sir.
And congratulations on your new president of DC Homebrewers Club.
Thank you.
It's exciting to see these experiments continue and continue to see the work that the Homebrewers Association DC Homebrewers Club is doing for beer education in the DC area.
Thank you.
Yeah. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, anything that you need, reach out to me at BeerMeRadio on Instagram or BeerMeRadio@gmail.com. I'm the host, Sarah Jane. This has been Beer Me on Full Service Radio at the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. We'll catch you next week. Cheers. Yeah.